We are now recording. So let's start as usual with a brief review of what we did last week. The basic problem we are concerned with is the externality problem, which is that external costs and external benefits are not included in the calculation. So the basic argument is that in a world where every time somebody makes a decision, he gets all the benefits and bears all the costs, now individual rationality will produce group rationality. Is that way of putting it make sense to you? That we assume that people on the whole can figure out what actions are in their interest and take them. We would like to structure our society so that if everybody acts in his own interest, the result will make all of us better off in some sense. We'll maximize the size of the pie. One very simple rule, if you can arrange it, is to set it up so that whenever I make a decision, I get the benefits and bear the costs. Now, every decision I make, I will make it if benefits are larger than costs, not make it if benefits are less than costs. If everybody does that for all decisions, we get all the right decisions made. Is that sort of simple version of the argument clear to people or not? Yes? No? Yeah? All right. So then the problem, externalities are one place where this scheme breaks down, where you don't get that result, and that's because I'm taking an action and I get the benefits and you get the costs. Or I'm taking an action and I pay the costs and you get the benefits. Either way, I'll make the wrong calculation. If there are external costs, then I'll sometimes take the action when I shouldn't, when total costs are greater than total benefits, but private costs are less than private benefits. If the benefit is external, then I sometimes won't take the action even though total benefits are larger than total costs, because private benefits are less than private costs. That's the basic problem. Pigou has a very simple solution to that problem, which, putting it this way, makes seem very plausible and obvious, and that is, if I impose a cost on you, have some legal mechanism to push the cost back onto me, to make me internalize the cost. And one example of such a mechanism is that if I pollute, I am charged an effluent fee, which represents some estimate of the damage done by my pollution. Now I am bearing all the costs. I'm presumably getting the benefit of the goods I produce and sell, so I will pollute only if the damage done by the pollution is less than the cost of producing it. And one way of reducing my pollution is to produce less. That shows up in the price that I charge my customers, which now includes the pollution cost. So if including the pollution cost, the goods aren't worth it to the customers, they don't buy them, I don't produce them, and that's a different margin on which pollution is reduced. That's Pigou's solution. It's persuaded economists for 30 years or so. And Coase's critique of that solution, I put in three stages. It really starts out with the observation that saying I'm imposing a cost on you is really a misstatement of the problem, because the cost exists because of choices both of us make typically. Yours, mine, of where, of how much to pollute, yours of where to live, say. And so Coase first says, if the Pigouvian tax is put on the higher cost avoider, if it is less costly for you to avoid the problem of airport noise by living somewhere else than for me to avoid it by soundproofing my airplanes, Pigou makes me responsible. I solved the problem at a high cost when you could have solved it at a low cost. That's an inefficient outcome. And in that particular case, if there were no legal rule telling me that I was liable for the sound, I would keep making the sound and you would move, and that would get the efficient outcome with no Pigouvian intervention at all. So therefore, Coase says, sometimes Pigou's solution is unnecessary and sometimes it makes the problem worse. So, and it wouldn't work to simply say, well, the people under the airline are always liable, because sometimes the airline might be the lower cost avoider. So unless you know in advance who is the lower cost avoider, you can't use a scheme of Pigouvian taxes to solve the problem. In addition, sometimes the lowest cost avoider is both of us. Sometimes there are some things to reduce the cost one party should do and one the other. And again, Pigou doesn't get you that. Then Coase says, wait a minute, actually everything works. Everything works if you allow for the fact that if you have an inefficient outcome, it's in the interest of the parties to bargain to change it. And one way you could put it is to say, look, no Pigouvian tax, I'm polluting you downwind, you're my only neighbor. There is a cost to me of polluting you. There is indeed something that makes me internalize that externality. And that's the fact that in order to keep polluting you, I've got to turn down your offer to pay me to stop. That's a cost to me too. So in a zero transaction cost world, you, the quote victim unquote, will make offers to me, if I have the legal right to pollute, in effect to buy the right to pollute away from me. And if the damage of the pollution is larger than the cost of controlling it, one of those offers will get accepted. So the second stage of Coase's argument, the one that Stigler called the Coase theorem, is if there are no transaction costs, as long as we start out defining property rights in some way, we will always bargain to the efficient outcome. And that, of course, leads you to the third step, which is we don't live in a world of zero transaction costs, and therefore the problems do exist, but they exist not because I'm imposing a cost on you, but because of the combined fact that there is a cost due to our joint action and that the transaction costs of including that cost in both of our decisions are high enough so we don't do it. All right? So that then gets you focusing on transaction costs, which becomes important because sometimes transaction costs are high and sometimes low. And if you imagine, let us say, if we go back to the beginning and we say nothing works, we say, well, suppose we have a case where either A or B could adjust, we don't know which. But suppose it's also the case that if the legal rule gives A the right to take the action, it'll be very easy for B to buy it from him. But if it gives B the right to take the action, it'll be very hard for A to buy it from him because of the particular transaction costs. Maybe A is a single person and B is a group of people or something like that. In that case, Coase's argument says, aha, we've now figured out how to write the law. We now want to make our initial definition of property rights in that fashion, which either directly gives us the efficient outcome, or makes it possible, if we got it wrong, to rearrange to the efficient outcome at low transaction costs, so it'll probably happen. And that's a way you can read Coase as a formula for designing legal rules. Now, to be fair, what I'm describing is in part an article of mine about Coase, and Coase's comment on the article was that you never really understand your ideas until someone else explains them to you. And given Coase, I do not to this day know if he had his tongue in his cheek when he made that comment or not. But in any case, it is a way in which I find it useful to apply Coase's insights to what you can think of as one of the sort of central law and econ projects, which is how will you design an efficient legal system. All right. Questions? Comments? All right. Well, how do you do it? One possibility, and the way in which, in my view, people often misread Coase, is to imagine that the court in each case says, all right, you're the low-cost avoider, so you got to fix the problem, or you'll be liable if you don't fix the problem. No, no, in this one, he's the low-cost avoider. And that, it seems to me, is unlikely to be workable in most cases, because it would require the court or the regulator to have a level of detailed knowledge that they're not likely to have, and the incentives to use that knowledge correctly. And that could be done in the regulatory form of saying you must filter your smokestack. It could be done in the Pigouvian form of saying you are liable for the costs imposed by your pollution, but he who chooses to live downwind from you is not liable for the fact that by doing that he imposes a cost on you because you now have to reduce your pollution because he's breathing it. The alternative, and the one which I at least find a much more interesting and practical option, is to say the court's going to make general rules so people can do their planning knowing what the legal rule is, but in designing the general rules, you want to try to use the Coasean insights to say, all right, who is usually the lower cost avoider? If he isn't, how hard will it be to shift the transactions to get it to the lowest cost avoider? And basically Chapter 5 takes a single sort of stylized problem of this sort and works out in agonizing but not complete detail how you would do this kind of analysis. That's what that chapter is about. And I suggest that one example of such a legal rule is coming to the nuisance, that the argument basically is that typically the last mover is the low-cost avoider because of what economists think of as sunk costs, that one of the costs of building a housing development is surveying the land and laying out the streets and building the houses, but that's only a cost after you've paid it. Before you've paid it, you can say, no, we haven't done any of that stuff, we'll do it somewhere else. And that suggests that typically the guy who came first and who built his pig farm, his costs are sunk costs. He can't say, oops, I made a mistake, let me get back all the money I spent to set up a pig farm and go somewhere else. Whereas the guy who comes second, sees the pig farm is there, says, well, maybe I should build my development elsewhere. So that gives you a presumption for the idea that the lower cost avoider is typically the last mover, the second mover in this case, and that justifies the common law rule of coming to the nuisance. Make sense? Doesn't make sense? Fine. And you can argue that last clear chance is a similar rule. There are other issues where you can think of applying the same approach. One of them is the distinction between bright line rules and standards. All right, so that in order to be elected president, you must be at least 35. That's a bright line rule. In order to be appointed a judge, you must be of good moral character. I don't know if that's the way they put it, but there are lots of rules of that general sort. That's a standard, and that requires somebody to sort of weigh and balance whether you count as of good moral character or not. And the advantage of the bright line rule is that you know almost always with certainty whether somebody is or isn't 35, so you can make all your plans without worrying about trying to second guess a court. But the problem with the bright line rule is that since most real world issues are too complicated to sum up in a single bright line, it will sometimes give the wrong answer. So if the bright line rule is you may not drive 70 miles an hour, more than 70 miles an hour, that's the wrong rule if my wife is in the process of going into labor in the back seat. It's the wrong rule if I'm a heart surgeon, I'm the only person who can perform an operation, and the patient will die in 15 minutes if I don't get to the hospital. So it's a pretty good bright line rule, but it's not a perfect one. And in that case, maybe you modify it by having the policeman, the traffic cop, recognize the situation and not enforce the rule. That's a way in which we get in between bright line rules and standards. A lot of this suggests that one of the things we haven't thought about, one of the things that matters, but something which in fact, as far as I can tell, law and econ people haven't thought about very much, is the technology of adjudication. What kind of questions are courts good at answering? That kind of issue. Another area where you'd want to apply these same principles is defining property rights, because as aspiring lawyers presumably know, nobody really owns a piece of land. What somebody really owns is a bundle of rights with regard to that land. And they may or may not include mineral rights, they don't include overfly rights unless you're overflying very low, they don't include rights to prevent people broadcasting radio signals across it unless the signals are on the level of a microwave oven. Kind of intensity, so you really have a bundle of rights. And then we'll discuss later in the chapter on property the issue of how do we decide what ought to go into the bundle. But one way of thinking about that is if we have two different rights, do they belong in the same bundle? And the first question is one of them typically most valuable to the person who owns the other? So if you say, well, I've got the right to grow grain on this land. Well, another right that might go on the bundle is the right to walk on the land. Very hard to grow grain on the land without walking on the land. So it seems plausible that those belong in the same bundle. How about the right to exclude other people from walking on the land? Well, for grain, that probably belongs in the same bundle. But if I'm growing timber, it's not so clear because it's sort of hard to trample a tree unless it's really small. So you could think of how you would define property rights depending on how the land is being used, how you would define those bundles. And you could imagine in some contexts that the right ought to include the right to prevent trespass, in others it might not. In some you might think it ought to include mineral rights, in others not, and so forth. For example, if you have a particular, if the relevant mineral resource is one which can only be accessed by drilling holes in the land immediately above that resource, then it would make a lot of sense to say the guy who owns the land also owns the mineral resource. If the relevant mineral resource is one that can be accessed in lots of ways, it's oil and I can drill a hole here and drain land out from under your property, and if the really critical thing on the mineral resource is the expenditure on finding it, then you might want to say the resource belongs to the person, just as in sort of prospectors getting claims, that if I locate a pool of oil under your land, the land belongs to you, but the oil belongs to me. You can imagine rules like that. And in all of these, you want to think about how rights are best done. And as Coase suggests, you also want to think about, if we get the initial bundling wrong, how easy will it be for parties by private transactions to change it? And finally, going back to my idea of property rights or liability rights, if we guess wrong, is it better to say the guy who owns the land owns the mineral rights, I, the oil company that's found the oil, I'm really the most valuable holder of those mineral rights, so I'll buy the rights from you? Or is it better to say, for some reason it's very hard to do the transaction, I'll just drill and pump oil from under your land, you'll sue me for damages? That would be a liability. That's the way we handle traffic accidents, all right? I don't get your permission to drive, I drive and do or don't damage you, and only if I damage you do you sue. So that kind of question, these are all things you can approach in this way. Coase makes a bunch of other points in the article, and I think I'll probably go, it's probably worth mentioning them in advance so you recognize them when you see them. One of them, which is a point that's a good deal more standard now than it was then, is that it's not enough to show that the market outcome is less than the perfect outcome that a perfectly wise planner would create, because we have a shortage of perfectly wise planners. You really want to ask, is there an alternative arrangement which would actually produce a better outcome? And furthermore, Coase goes even further back, because actually we don't even know what laissez-faire means. It's not really well defined, because any market is occurring with some structure of property rights. Typically, though not inevitably, those property rights were defined by a government. So when you say, this is what happens if the government doesn't step in, you mean this is what happens if the government establishes a certain set of property rights and then doesn't step in. And he, in fact, goes into some detail, I think pretty clearly intended for amusement as well as information, in taking Pigou's example, which involved a railroad throwing sparks, and pointing out that whether or not the externality problem Pigou describes exists in the form he says would depend on what date in English history the event happened, because the relevant laws about the liability for throwing sparks changed. It would depend on whether or not the railroad was chartered by Parliament, because if I remember correctly, railroads chartered by Parliament weren't liable for the fires and other railroads. He goes into a lot of detail, where his real point is, if you actually stop looking at the stylized facts and look at the real world, it turns out that who's liable for what isn't, chiseled in stone until the government arrives. It is a description of an existing legal system. So, what Chapter 5 is doing. As you can see, you're designing a law code, you've read Coase and you think you understand it, how do you figure out what the rules are? And we're trying to go through that for one simple case. So what's the story in this chapter? We have one railroad, 100 farmers. The railroad, when it runs its railroad cars, throws sparks. This is an old-fashioned railroad back when they were burning coal. It was a real-world problem. And the sparks start fires in the wheat fields along the railroad route. And the farmers have the option of switching to clover. Presumably the reason they're now growing wheat is that wheat's a more profitable crop than clover, but clover's better than nothing, and clover, at least in my stylized story, doesn't burn. The railroad has the option of putting on a spark arrestor, which is this big sort of metal mesh thing that goes on top of the smokestack of a locomotive, and theoretically at least catches all the sparks as they go out. But that's costly. So therefore, we have a nice simple case of, here is a problem, the fires in the wheat fields. This problem can be controlled, and in my simple case, completely eliminated by either party at some cost. Now, I should say, there are other dimensions one could be looking at, but I'm not, although some of them Coase does. In particular, you could imagine the railroad adjusting not by putting on a spark arrestor, but by running fewer trains. All right. One possibility is to say maybe one train a day is cost justified, but the second train doesn't carry enough traffic to be worth the fires it starts. We're not going in that direction, though obviously a more complete analysis would. And I'm assuming one railroad and 100 farmers, and the reason that matters is that the existence of 100 farmers means that if they want to bribe the railroad to do something, they've got to overcome a public good problem to do it. They've got to overcome the problem that each of them will want the others to pay and sees no reason why he should pay. People don't follow that argument. And there are some other problems associated with numbers. We then have two legal questions. One of them is who has the right to decide, and the other is a property right or a liability right. So if you think about two decisions, one of them is wheat or clover, one of them is spark arrestor or no spark arrestor. If you have no spark arrestor and wheat, you will have fires. So the second question is, if you do have fires, is it the railroad or the farmers who have to bear the cost? If there's no tort liability, the farmers bear it. If the railroad is liable, the railroad bears it. So you could imagine the railroad having a property right to throw sparks, which means both that the railroad can decide whether or not to put on a spark arrestor, and that the railroad is not liable for the damages from the resulting fires. That's one possible legal rule. A second possible legal rule is that the farmers have a right, but only a liability right against sparks. So that means the farmers can't require the railroad to put on the spark arrestor. They can't get an injunction, but the railroad has to pay for the damage done by the fires. An alternative rule might be that the farmers have a property right against sparks, that they get to decide whether or not the railroad has a spark arrestor, and they don't have to pay for the spark arrestor. Finally, you could imagine a case, it seems a little odd, but it's possible that there's such a legal rule, where the railroad has a liability right, meaning that the farmers can order the railroad to put on a spark arrestor, but then the farmers have to pay for the spark arrestor. All right. I think the technical term is incomplete privilege. It's a fairly unusual rule, but it's logically a possibility. Now, one can think about more rules, and we'll discuss that a little bit later. In particular, I'm not considering rules at the moment where the railroad can order the farmers to grow clover, which would be another, if I wanted to expand it to a more complete set of alternatives. But I think, as you'll see, four make it complicated enough for our purposes. People follow my four alternatives. Right? Who gets to decide whether or not there's a spark arrestor, railroad, or farmers? Who bears the cost of any fires that occur, railroad, or farmers? That gives you four alternatives. So you can imagine a variety of alternative rules, but we're not going to go there. Railroad has the property right, farmers have the property right, farmers have the liability right, railroad has the liability. Suppose the railroad has the property right. And furthermore, suppose that sparks plus wheat plus fire is optimal. People understand what I mean when I say it's optimal? I mean that the cost of putting on the spark arrestor is greater than the damage done by the fires. So we'd be worse off on net with the spark arrestor. And the cost of switching to clover is greater than the damage done by the fires. So we'd be worse off switching to clover. All right, that either way of eliminating the fires costs more than it's worth, so the least cost solution is to put up with some fires in your wheat fields. If that's the right, if that's where we want to go, if that's the right way for people to behave, what's going to happen? Are any transactions going to be needed? The rule is the railroad can throw sparks if it feels like it and it's not liable to anybody. What's going to happen? What? That is, the railroad will throw sparks, the farmers won't choose to switch to clover because that will lose them more money than the fires are losing them, and we will get the optimal solution directly with no transaction involved. Is that point clear? I'm sorry, I'm always unsure when there is silence whether that means that I am half an hour behind you or half an hour ahead of you, and those require different responses on my part. So if sparks plus wheat plus fire is optimal, it happens. How about if sparks plus clover is optimal? Do we need transactions there? Anybody?
Are they already growing clover? Or
what? They start out, we're imagining that before the railroad is built, they were growing wheat. Railroad comes in. The courts say the railroad has the property right. This railroad was chartered by Parliament. Railroads are good for England, and therefore they are not going to be liable for the fires, which I gather is what in some cases happened. So under that rule, if clover is optimal, if Sparks plus clover is optimal, which means that the cost of switching from wheat to clover is lower than the cost of putting on a Spark arrestor. All right. In that case, under this legal rule, what's going to happen? The farmers will switch to clover, and no transaction is necessary. Right? The railroad throws Sparks, the farmers observe the fires, they say, oops, growing wheat is less profitable than clover given that we've got these fires in the wheat field, so let's switch to clover. Is that clear to everybody? Yes? No? Happens. How about if the Spark arrestor is optimal? Now what happens? Suppose that the lowest cost solution is to put on a Spark arrestor. Anybody? Does it happen? How does it happen? In order for it to happen, the farmers will have to pay the railroad to put on the Spark arrestor. Will that happen? Why will it or why won't it?
Depends on whether the railroad is waiting and has enough incentive to switch.
On whether what?
Whether the railroad is waiting to switch.
The railroad is willing to switch if they are paid more than the cost of the Spark arrestor. And by assumption, since the Spark arrestor is optimal, the value to the farmers of getting rid of the fires is greater than the cost of the Spark arrestor. Are there problems? Anybody? You're a farmer. What do? There are 100 farmers. That Spark arrestor is going to cost 10,000 pounds, and you're only saving a few hundred pounds by putting it on because you're one of the 100 farmers. So you're not going to offer them 10,000 pounds to save yourself 200 pounds, are you? Yeah?
It might be free riders.
The free riders is a problem. So what are you going to have to? What are you going to? You're a farmer. What are you going to have to do?
Free riders.
What are you going to have to do in order to get rid of that? In order to get that Spark arrestor on? Will you pay for it yourself? Not unless the cost is less than a hundredth of the damage, right? So what will you do instead?
Switch.
That's one possibility. Switch to clover. What's the alternative?
Keep growing wheat and hope for the other farmers to get frustrated and pay the cost instead.
Well, no other farmers going to do it for the same reason, yeah? That's it. What you can try to do is to get the farmers together. This may or may not work, but what you can try to do is say to the other farmers, look, let's have a big meeting in my barn. You guys are all having this problem. You can smell the smoke even today as we're here in the barn. How about I ship in 50 pounds, you ship in 50 pounds, he ships in 50 pounds, she ships in 50 pounds, and all of us together, we know that we've gotten some estimates, and we know that the Spark arrestor only costs a quarter as much as the damage being done to us. So each of us is willing, each of us to save 100 pounds is willing to pay 30 pounds or so. That'll be a generous offer to the room. That's what we try to do. And then the problem, as you say, is the free rider problem. How do I get other people to agree to that, given that each of them is going to say, if you can persuade the others, that's great, but you don't really need me. And you could imagine various bargaining strategies I could use, ranging from the unanimous contract strategy, which consists of my saying, look, unless everybody agrees to chip in 30 pounds, we're not doing this. So for any of you, if you'd back out, if someone else backs out, it doesn't matter if you back out or not. If everybody else goes along and you back out, that torpedoes the plan, so everybody should agree. And there are problems getting that to work. Different approach is to say, look, we're friends. We all go to the same square dances. Our wives knit together. Our kids play together. Do you want me to think you're the kind of selfish SOB who wouldn't go along with this obviously public-spirited plan? You can think of a lot of ways you can try to solve these problems. I don't want to treat it as if public good problems were inherently insoluble, but they are a problem. All right? And that therefore, whereas in the first two cases, it looks as though if one of those outcomes is optimal, zip, it happens. In the third case, it happens only through a transaction. That transaction is blocked by the public good problem, so may or may not occur. What are some of the variables that they would expect to determine whether it occurs? Can you describe, in general, that is, I don't want to limit it to this case. Can you describe two conditions, either of which would make it almost certain that it would occur, or make it very likely that it would occur? One of them is if there's one farm who is big enough so that the benefit to him alone will pay for the spike arrestor, and more than pay for the spike arrestor. And the other guys say, look, you can't expect us little guys to go along, but you can do it, and it's in his interest to do it. And in the economic literature, that's referred to as a privileged minority. It's a funny term because he's got the privilege of paying for what everybody else gets, but that's a plausible way of doing it. And in fact, everybody in this room is a privileged minority. All right? The public good I'm thinking of is our own physical appearance, whether or not we try to dress nicely, do our hair, and all the different ways. That provides, presumably, we hope, some benefits for the rest of the world, for all the people who look at us and see a pleasanter world because we're not looking too horrible. But each of us believes he gets a large enough fraction of the benefit, except the people who choose to go around in rags, but presumably most of us believe we get a large enough fraction of the benefit, so we're willing to pay the entire cost. Similarly, I own a house. I'm a privileged minority in that I've got some incentive to mow the lawn and have the house painted and stuff, which makes things nicer for my neighbors or people driving by on the street, but I get such a large fraction of the benefit that I'm willing to bear the whole cost. So one of the ways that you could do it would be if either the public was tiny, so that there were only three people and they could get together easily, or, as you say, if the distribution of the benefit was uneven enough so that some one person or maybe two or three people who could get together could be willing to fund the whole thing. What's another variable that might affect it, which I actually mentioned earlier in passing? What's the situation in which you as a single farmer, if you give up on the rest of the SOBs, would be willing to pay for it yourself? That's right. If that spark arrestor, you can get them for $12.50, and it's going to save me $10,000. Don't be absurd. I'll pay for it myself and just look down at the rest of you idiots for not doing it. Right? So on the one hand, if the ratio of benefit to cost is very high, now it becomes, there's a strong reason for somebody to do it. And on the other hand, if some individual beneficiary or small group of beneficiaries get a large enough fraction of the benefit so they won't do it themselves. So it's not that it's undoable, it's just that it's a problem. So here's my spaghetti diagram, which presumably you've already seen in the book, and if it isn't obvious why it's a spaghetti diagram, it soon will be. And that's showing that if we start with a property right by the railroad, we can go directly to sparks plus wheat plus fires equals fires. We can go directly to sparks plus clover and no fires. We can go to no sparks plus wheat and no fires, but only through solving a public good problem. So that one is blocked, and how serious the blockage is will depend on the situation. Right. Follow so far? How about if the farmers have the property right? Now, if the spark arrestor is optimal, what happens? You're a farmer. Those SOBs keep throwing sparks and starting fires. What do? You have a property right. You've got a legal right to forbid them from throwing sparks. So what do? Well, you enjoin them. Right. That is, or you just tell them, I'll call the cops, or the equivalent of that. But what you do is to use the legal process to forbid them from throwing sparks. So that one is easy. But what if sparks are optimal? What if, in fact, the spark arrestor is very expensive? Now what's going to have to happen? In order to get the efficient result, which is no spark arrester, which is sparks are thrown and we have either clover or wheat, what's going to have to happen to get to there?
The railroad
has to buy the right. So you're a farmer, and what might you do in this world if you're a ambitious, thoughtful fellow? What do in this world after the railroad protests to you, look, it's going to cost us a fortune to put on this spark arrestor? You negotiate. What's the problem here? Is there a problem here? It's actually, I'm not certain. I think it's useful to think of the holdout problem as not identical to the public good problem. The problem here is that that, as I've described it, any one farmer can enjoin. So it does the railroad no good to buy the right from me to not put on a spark register. It has to buy them for everybody. And now the problem is that each of them is likely to say, well, look, that spark arrestor would cost you 50,000 pounds. I'm a moderate guy. Give me 5,000 pounds and I'll give you permission. But if everybody asks that, that adds up to more than the total 50,000 because there are 100 of us. And so then we have to somehow coordinate our activities in such a way that nobody, that people's attempts to get more than their proportional share, which each person has an inclination to try to do, don't block the result. And you can see, if I imagine there are 100 of us, and the spark arrestor costs, say, 100,000 pounds to make the arithmetic easy, then the at a maximum, the railroad would be willing to pay 1,000 pounds to each of us, or anything up to that. The fires are only doing 100 pounds damage, so each of us, in principle, would accept a 101-pound bribe. But if all of you people are accepting 101-pound bribes, I can hold out for several thousand pounds. All right, and that's a problem. It's a problem. People often associate that with the problem of building roads, that how do you deal with the fact that you need permission from every landowner along the route, and that's an argument offered for eminent domain. It's not as strong an argument there as it is here, because usually there are alternative routes for the road, and so you can always say, well, if you're too greedy, I'll route around your property. But not always. If, however, the transaction does happen, if the railroad buys permission from the farmers to throw sparks, now the farmers can choose wheat or clover. Second version of the spaghetti diagram, we're starting out now with a property right by the farmers. It goes directly to... Whoops, I have that wrong. That holdout problem should be higher up. It should go over both of those. Right. Because the holdout problem is going to prevent going to either of the sparks outcomes if it's a property right, and you could get directly only to the no sparks. And no sparks plus wheat, no sparks plus clover, you can't get directly to, but that's never going to be efficient because we're assuming that wheat's more profitable than clover. So if there aren't any sparks, there's no reason to grow clover. So I'm not interested in this fourth alternative, even though it's logically possible. We never want to go there. Questions? Clear? How about farmers have the liability right? If sparks plus wheat plus fire is optimal, it happens. Because now if sparks plus wheat plus fire is optimal, the railroad throws the sparks and it then pays the damages to the farmer. And if sparks plus wheat plus fire is optimal, that means that the damages the railroad is paying are less than the cost did of putting on the spark arrestor, so it's willing to make that choice. But notice that this does raise two other issues we've so far ignored. One of them is it's assuming the court can actually measure the damages. If the court overestimates the damages, then the railroad might put on the spark arrestor even though it wasn't efficient to do so. And also this is introducing the costs of litigation. What you people may be in the business of doing. How about if the optimal solution is sparks plus wheat plus clover? How are we going to get to that one? I really ought to make these slightly fancier PowerPoint slides so that I can have the question, if sparks plus fire is optimal, without the answer, and then discuss it and then put up the answer. But maybe next time I teach it, I'll do it that way. So if sparks plus wheat, so if sparks plus clover is optimal, if the right solution is that the railroad throws sparks and the farmer switch to clover, how can that happen? Or will it happen? You're a farmer, and every year you grow wheat, the railroad throws sparks, the sparks do 100 pounds worth of damage to your wheat, and the railroad pays you 100 pounds in damages. Somebody says, you know, this is pretty silly, growing all this wheat that's getting burned down. You realize that you'd only lose 50 pounds if you switched to clover instead. And you say, well, that's right. I wonder what I should do. What should you do? J. So you just switched to clover? That's right. You're getting the same income as if there were no fires because you're being compensated by the railroad. So what should you do? Here it is, 50 pounds a year being wasted. Surely a good Kosian will see some.
Either go tell the railroad, hey, pay me some money and I'll switch to wheat, it reduces your costs.
Switch to clover.
Or clover.
Right. Yeah, that seems the obvious solution would be that the farmer goes to the railroad and says, look, you're currently paying me 100 pounds a year in damages. If you're willing to pay me 75 pounds a year, I'll switch to clover. Right? Both of us will be better off. Is there a public good problem here? Not really, because each farmer can do it separately. Any farmer who chooses not to switch, we keep paying him 100 pounds a year and burning his wheat, right? It doesn't require everybody doing it. So in this case, the railroad can individually transact. Now, there may be some bargaining problems over the fact that the farmer wants 95 pounds and the railroad is offering 55 pounds, but that's not a public good problem. It's not a holdout problem. No farmer can block the outcome. The railroad's going to throw sparks, whatever happens. The only question is whether it pays damages or whether it pays a subsidy to those farmers who agree to switch to clover. All right? So, don't remember if that's my next one or not. Yes. So, if sparks plus clover is optimal, it doesn't happen without a transaction, but can happen if the railroad pays the farmers to switch. There are no big transaction problems except for whether or not the court can properly estimate damages, because if the court misestimates damages, you might get the wrong result. For example, if the court if the court underestimates damages, then they'll switch to clover on their own. If the court overestimates damages, then the railroad might put on the spark arrester, even though it wasn't worth doing. But as long as the court can estimate the damages, this works just fine. How about if the right solution is not to have sparks? Yep.
In that last example, someone who holds out at a certain point, their own fault, because they know that they're not producing,
that would be a possible legal rule, but it's not one of the ones that I'm considering. It's a little bit like a negligence rule, and I'm really considering the strict versions where whatever damage is. Let me put it differently. A different way of putting it is that a sufficiently sophisticated court would say your damage isn't really 100 pounds a year. Right. Your damage is really 50 pounds a year because you can take actions which will reduce the damage to 50 pounds a year. If the court knows that, then you're right. Then you get a different path of what happens, and then we don't require that bargaining at all. Yeah. And so it really, I'm in effect assuming that the court can look at the fires and estimate the damage, but it can't look at the general costs and benefits of growing different crops and estimate the damage from that. Yeah. And you could imagine there are two ways a fancier court could operate. One of them is the court could say they're not liable at all because you didn't minimize the damages. Or they could say, but if you do switch to clover, then they've got to pay you the 50 pounds because that was the cost to you of doing so. Or alternatively, they could say that they're liable, but only for the cost of the lowest cost if you minimize. And this really goes back to the point I made earlier that in some of these cases, both parties might want to adjust. So what if the right solution is not to have sparks? No sparks plus wheat. How do we get it in this case? Any transactions needed? That's right. And assuming the court measures damages correctly. Because now the railroad, in true Pigouvian fashion, is internalizing the externality, so it makes the right calculation. The railroad says that since no sparks are cheaper than paying for the damages, and also cheaper than paying people to switch to clover, because the assumption now is that no sparks is the optimum, so now we will just put on a spark arrester and stop visiting the court every year. So the third part of our spaghetti diagram tells us that to get to no sparks, wheat, and no fire, no negotiation is necessary. To get to sparks plus wheat equal fires, the only problems are chord error, and to get to sparks and clover and no fires is only negotiation cost problem. Finally, the railroad has the liability right, and any farmer can enjoin but must compensate. And there is, I know of one case whose name, not being a lawyer, I have forgotten, which a court actually imposed this rule, and this was something along my pig farmer lines, and in which, if I remember correctly, there was some kind of a big agricultural operation involving like a feedlot or a slaughterhouse, something of that sort, and somebody then built a large housing development close to it and then found that the stink from the agricultural operation was making people unwilling to buy their houses. And the court found that they could close down the operation, but they had to pay the moving costs or whatever the cost to them were. And that, I'm told, that rule is called incomplete privilege. It's not a very common legal rule, but it nicely fills in my set of four alternatives. All right? So under that rule, if the spark arrestor is optimal, it may not happen, because if one of the farmers enjoins, the others benefit, and basically the railroad, in effect, would have to get all of them to not enjoin. If there's no spark arrester is optimal, you're going to get wheat or clover, whichever is optimal, and if... That's right. Sorry. In this one, if one of them enjoins, he's going to have to pay for the cost of the spark arrester. So unless they all get together and agree to enjoin and share the cost, then it's not going to be a spark arrester. They're going to get sparks under that rule. And if the no spark arrester is optimal, then the nobody enjoins, sparks are thrown, and the farmers adjust to wheat or clover. That's our fourth part of the diagram. So we now step back and think about this as a sort of a general approach to understanding how you would construct legal rules. If you know what outcome is optimal, life's easy. If you know that railroads ought not to have spark arresters, if you know that the fires in the wheat fields are a minor problem, whereas spark arresters are really expensive, you then say, fine, we will give railroads the right to throw sparks. They're not liable for the sparks. If the farmers want to try to bargain with the railroads, they're welcome to, but it's not going to happen. That would be easy. Similarly, if you knew that the right rule was that the railroads should never throw sparks, you can then have an injunctive remedy. But if you go back and look at my diagram, you can ask for any final point. What are the unblemished arrows? The arrow is not blocked by anything to lead to it. Go back to the base of that arrow. That's where you want to start. On the other hand, if you imagine a more realistic case, we say we're making this rule, it's going to apply over the next 50 years to 73 different railroads and 30,000 different farmers. On average, what's the right rule? And what you then want to say is, over each of the cases where it's going to apply, how likely is it that the right answer is clover? How likely is it that the right answer is wheat plus sparks? How likely is it that the right answer is wheat plus no sparks? In the case where the right answer is wheat plus no sparks, if we start with this legal rule, how will we get there? In the case that, how will we get there? And then pick your legal rule to, in effect, minimize the average summed costs of getting it wrong. Does that way of putting it make sense to people or not? Yes? No? All right. And the one problem with that, with actually doing it, that is, what I'm claiming I can do is to demonstrate how, if you had enough information, you would design an efficient legal system. In the real world, you don't have enough information. This is true of lots and lots of theoretical exercises in different fields. That one step is to say, if we knew everything, how would we solve the problem? And then you say, well, we don't know everything, but what could we say about the solution given what we do know? And that's essentially the logic of what I'm doing. So I want to start out by saying, if we only knew how likely every situation was over the time the rule will apply, how costly all of the transactions are, which ones will occur, which ones won't occur, we could then say, here's the right rule. One of the several reasons we can't really do all of that is that we don't have a very good theory of transaction costs. We can point at particular problems like the public good problem, the holdout problem. But if you ask me, when you reduce the number of farmers from 100 to 90, how much do you increase the probability they will succeed in raising 50% of the value of a public good to them? Got me? No adequate theory to answer that question. So we can't really do it in a rigorous fashion. Now, hopefully this shows you why I call it a spaghetti diagram. It's a plate of, even more so when I didn't use straight lines, but even with straight lines, it looks like spaghetti that you haven't cooked yet in a big bundle. And that's showing that if you knew you wanted to end up here, sorry, you can't see what I'm touching. Can you see my cursor on the screen? Is it big enough? If you knew you wanted to end up here at Sparks plus Wheat and Fires, you would start with either a property right by the railroad, or you could do it with a liability right by the railroad, although that one you'd have some costs from suing. If you knew you wanted to end up with Sparks plus Clover and no fires, property right by the railroad, again, liability right by the railroad, but you'd have some court costs. If you knew you wanted to end up here, though, you don't want either of those starting points. You then want liability right by farmers, and you never want to end up here under the assumptions I've given. All right? All clear? So what's the general procedure? If we start with this rule, how do we get to whichever result is efficient, and what keeps us from doing it? So now going over, because it's now on the slide, what I was just saying, if we're imagining that we were really solving the problem when we really knew all the net relevant things, start with a particular case. One railroad, 100 farmers, the efficient outcome is Sparks and Wheat. And the inefficiency, if we don't get to Sparks and Wheat, if we get to Sparks and Clover, that costs us 3,000 pounds a year more. If we get to no Sparks and Wheat, that costs us 6,000 pounds more. So I'm imagining a particular case where we knew all the facts. We could then say, well, if we start with a legal rule, which is property rights by farmers, then that will get us to the right result immediately, no costs. If we start with a legal rule, which is here, that'll get us to that result only with a transaction cost of 3,000 pounds to do X. If we start here, it won't get us to the right result at all because the transaction cost is too high, so we will have the inefficiency of ending up wherever it does get it to. So if we imagine a single fully specified case that we knew enough, we could then do the calculation and say, all right, this rule works, this rule is 3,000 pounds a year worse, this rule is 6,000 pounds a year worse. People see the logic of how you could do that if you only knew enough. Now suppose we knew not just a single specified case, but all of the cases that would occur in the future and how likely each one was. How likely is it there will be 93 farmers instead of 100? How likely is it that the efficient outcome will be a spark arrester? How likely is it that if you don't have a spark arrester, the net cost of the fires will only be 2,000 pounds instead of 3,000 pounds? All right. For each possible thing that we do the same calculation. And we end up saying, well, in this situation, the net cost of this rule is 2,000 pounds, the net cost of this is 3, the net cost of this is 7, the net cost of this is 9,000, the chance of the situation is 1%, multiply each of those costs by 1%, and ex ante, that's the cost of using that rule. Repeat for each rule. Find the one that's cheapest, and we're home free. So that's in the abstract, how we would design a legal system using Coase's ideas if we knew it. So we've now solved the general problem, but requiring more knowledge than we have. What can we actually get out of it? We can get qualitative results which say, here is how changing our assumptions makes one rule more or less attractive. So we can say that if there are large numbers on one side, that means the public good problem is less likely to be solved. So therefore, any starting point that requires solving the public good problem to get to a likely ending point becomes less attractive. All right. if we have a situation where we know that almost always spark arresters are very expensive, therefore almost always they're the wrong solution, well, that will give us an argument for those legal rules that make it easy to get to solutions without spark arresters, even if they get hard to get solutions with spark arresters. Similarly, for whether cases are, whether damages are easy or hard to measure, the harder they are to measure, the more errors we will get from a liability rule, because the liability rule requires the court to measure damages. Questions? People understand, don't understand? Too abstract, not too abstract? I'm just curious. Let me take a vote. Is this way of thinking about it seems very natural to me. I'm not sure if it is to other people. Do you feel as though, having gone through this rather artificial exercise, you understand something more than you did before or not? Gone through includes reading the chapter as well as discussing in class. Any opinions?
Yes, but being very unfamiliar with economics, I would say that it would take me some additional time. As in, I see the basic framework, but there are a lot of gaps, and it would take additional luxuries of information.
Sure. Other comments? You know, I could leave this chapter out next time I teach the course. All right, let's think about, there are some other possible rules. Another rule might be a Pigouvian tax rather than liability. So a Pigouvian tax would say the railroads throw sparks. That's a mistake. Railroads can throw sparks, but have to pay for the cost of the resulting fires, but the payment is to the state, not to the farmers. Can you see the respect in which that's better than our previous liability rule? What's the situation in which the Pigouvian tax gets us to the efficient outcome where an ordinary liability rule might not?
If
what is the efficient outcome?
Throw sparks.
But whether you throw sparks, you wouldn't expect to be affected, would you? Because whether it's liability payments or Pigouvian fine, it's still the same payment for the railroad.
Right.
So whose behavior is going to be changed by switching from liability to Pigouvian tax? What? The farmers. How will theirs behave, be changed? And therefore, what is the situation in which we will now easily get the efficient outcome when we wouldn't before?
Clover,
that's right. Because now what happens is that the farmer says to himself, I'm not getting compensated for the fires. Given that these fires are happening, am I better off with clover or wheat? If the switching to clover is cheaper than putting up with the fires, I switch to clover. So the advantage of the Pigouvian tax now is that the liability rule eliminates the, quote, victim's incentive to minimize the problem. The Pigouvian tax doesn't. On the other hand, and this is my next one, and this is that what happens in this world is, suppose, in fact, the spark arrestor is the cheapest solution, and the railroad doesn't put it on. And the stockholders of the railroad go to the president of the railroad and they say, why aren't you putting this on? We're now paying 100,000 pounds a year in fines to the British government. And the president says, wait a while, be patient, my children, and you will see. And sure enough, after they've done it long enough to convince the farmers that the railroad is not going to put on the spark arrestor, the farmers all switch to clover. They switch to clover, there are no fires, there are no Pigouvian taxes, and the president of the railroad says, don't I deserve my bonus? It's true, we could have solved the problem quite cheaply with the spark arrestor, but we've solved it even more cheaply for us by getting the farmers to switch to clover. So even if we imagine a case where the spark arrestor was cheaper than switching to clover, in that world, it's not going to happen automatically, whereas in the other one it would have. So that's one problem. And then the other point is the one I made earlier, that Coase plus Pigou may give you too strong an incentive, because even if the sparks are optimal, we may not get them, because putting on a spark arrestor not only avoids the fine, you may also be able to go to the farmers and say, look, we've decided we're not going to put on the spark arrestor. The fine still is less costing the spark arrestor. And the farmers say, well, we'll ship in some extra money to get you to put on the spark arrestor. Fine does us no good, and your fires are still burning our wheat. So that's, again, a conceivable problem. On the other hand, as I say at the bottom, it's probably not a big problem with 100 farmers, because now the public good problem prevents the Coasean solution, and therefore it's really Pigou plus a tiny bit of Coase. So it's not going to get you very much inefficiency. Is that? Let's think about another possible legal rule, and this happens to be a real-world one that's important in one context I know of, and that's to have a rule that lets a majority or supermajority of the group make decisions for the whole group. So you could imagine a rule where the farmers somehow are under a legal rule which says if a majority of the farmers vote to enjoin the railroad, to insist on a spark arrestor, they all have to agree to share the damages, the cost of the spark arrestor. Or a rule which says if a majority of the farmers vote for a levy of 25 pounds per farmer to bribe the railroad to have a spark arrestor, they all have to pay it. All right? That's a majority rule for the group. And in fact, the interesting real-world example of this is unitization of oil fields. Do people know about unitization? Is it a real-world case? Well, the problem is that oil is a fluid. So if you imagine a situation where we have a poop, okay, where we have a magic marker which didn't have its cover left off, there's a pool of oil. We have several different property owners who own land above that pool of oil. If this property owner drills a well down here and starts pumping, what do you think happens? He's getting most of the oil, and it's going to gradually flow out from under the other property owners. Suppose the legal rule is just anybody's allowed to drill wells on his land and pump, which seems the obvious rule. What's going to happen? What?
They're
going to race the pump and they're going to all drill. Well, all drilling is inefficient because drilling is expensive, and one hole, probably maybe two, is sufficient to get all the oil out. Furthermore, it happens that part of what you're doing when you're getting oil out is using the pressure of the gas that's in the reservoir to push the oil out. The faster you get the oil out, typically the less you get, because you're basically using up that limited amount of gas pressure to push it out. So the result of all of them pumping is that the cost of extracting is higher and the amount extracted lower than if they just had one hole and pumping that. And the solution to this, in some states at least, I don't think it's true in all states, is what's called unitization. And with that, that's a legal procedure by which a vote is taken among all the landowners who own land above a common pool of oil. You've got to have evidence that there is a common pool of oil there. And I think it's usually a supermajority. I think it's usually like two-thirds or three-quarters can vote to unitize the pool. And what that means is that although each owner still has the ordinary property rights in his land, now the property right to the oil under the land is a common property right which each of them has a share in, rather than each of them having an unlimited right to drill from his land. And then under some rules, and I don't know how they do it, whether they just do it by how many acres you have over the pool or what, but there's some rule for dividing up the profits and for making decisions and dividing up the costs, and now in effect you have turned the oil part of it into something like a corporation which they're all stockholders in, rather than a exploitable resource that each of them has an unlimited right to exploit. On the other hand, that raises problems, and they're essentially the problems that I suspect you've already encountered if you look at issues of corporate law, which is how does one control a corporation to prevent two different problems. One problem is management stealing the stockholders blind, How do you keep management from paying themselves high salaries, giving themselves lots of perks, and that comes out of the dividends? And the other problem is, how do you prevent one group of stockholders, a majority, or at least a functional majority, if not many votes, from using their position to exploit the other stockholders? So you could imagine cases here where the different landowners have, for some reason, different interests in how the oil is pumped, and you then have the problem of forming coalitions to try to vote for what one group or another wants. So that's a set of problems that you create, but at the same time you're solving this common pool problem. I should say, we'll be discussing at much greater length when we get to property rights the general issue of property versus commons. A commons is something that, like the air we breathe, where anybody can use it as much as he wants, subject to the fact that you might all run out in some cases. And our term originally is used for the common fields in English villages in the Middle Ages, where you had a field that multiple villagers could graze their cattle. And there are advantages and disadvantages to commons, and there are advantages and disadvantages to property, which is going to be part of the subject of our chapter on property. As you may know, one of the disputes now going on intellectual property issues is the question of to what extent intellectual property should be a commons, as it is without copyright or patent rules, and to what extent it should be property, as it is with copyright or patent. Currently, it's both. There are some things that are unpatentable, they're uncopyrightable, or copyright is expired, they're all in the commons, and there are other things which are covered by it. And some people, there's this creative commons movement of Larry Lessig's, which is trying in various ways to get more stuff into the commons. And sort of the simplest way you can do it is you produce a piece of intellectual property, you're not planning to collect any license fees on it, so you in effect publicly announce, here are the rules under anybody who wants can use it. But we'll get to that later. Let's think now about a different distinction, which I mentioned briefly before, which is property rights or liability rules, property or liability rules. And here, a property rule basically means you can't use the property without the owner's permission. And of course, can't really means if you do, we'll punish you severely enough so you'll regret it. And liability rule means anybody can use it, but you owe the owner compensation for the costs that you impose on him by using it. All right? So one way of putting it is that property right is enough punishment to deter, and liability right is punishment equal to damage done. And obviously the first statement is always too simple, because my car is protected by a property right, there is nonetheless some risk it'll be stolen. So it doesn't deter everybody, but that's at least sort of a first approximation description. And then the question is, why would you want one or the other? Suppose, for example, that we allocated, should find a different example. Suppose we handled all cases of nuisance by property rights. So we say, if I do anything which imposes a cost on my neighbors, whether it's a smoking chimney or a playing music too loud in my house, I must have their permission. And if I don't, they'll put me in jail. That would be a property right for controlling nuisances. And you can imagine it, for those of you who live in dormitories or apartments or something, you can imagine a rule which says you may only play your stereo after midnight if you have permission from the occupants of all of the adjacent rooms or apartments or whatever it is. And that would be a property rule. Alternative would be a rule which said you can do what you please, but here is our procedure for figuring out how much cost you're imposing on others, and you will have to pay them for that cost. And if you actually think about how property law works under the law of nuisance, there are some contexts where I impose a cost on you and I owe you damages, and there are others where I impose a cost on you and you get an injunction, which in effect is implementing a property. And then the question is, why do you want one or the other? What are the advantages and disadvantages? So what are the circumstances that would make a property rule unworkable or clumsy or undesirable? That's what?
Like I have to make noises obviously. And the pleasure to me is so great that even if I have to pay off them.
But in that case, won't you simply go to the person who has the property right and buy the right from him?
Yes.
After all,
there are a lot of them and they're all be very
So what you're really saying is it's not that it's unavoidable, it's that the transaction cost of buying the right is high. That's right. That's the relevant point. That after all, eating is unavoidable, drinking is unavoidable, and yet we don't normally have a rule which says I can go into a grocery store, steal food off the shelves, and my punishment will just be the value of the food stolen. That would be a liability rule. Instead, we use a property rule, but we say that's all right. There are lots of grocery stores. The transaction costs of my buying food are very low, so that works just fine. What are the circumstances in which a liability rule is going to work badly? Make alive. So property rule basically moves things to their highest value by transactions, by the fact that if I'm the highest valued user of some right, you're the one who actually has the right, I buy it from you, essentially. And that's a problem if transactions are hard, and one case where transactions are hard is if I have to buy the right from lots of people. Yep. What about the other way?
I'm not sure if I'm right, but would it be possible in a situation where the damage is so great that there's no way to remedy it? But that's almost like a
Well, but I suppose if you knew the damage was enormous, then that would just mean that the two become the same, because now the liability consists of everything you own, and we're going to cut you up and auction off your organs, and that looks an awful lot like a deterrent punishment. Yeah.
I would say in situations like the only example I can really think of off the top of my head is like a personal vehicle. Like a personal vehicle to the owner of the vehicle probably has a lot of value to it versus that to a thief. Where the value of the vehicle to a thief who steals the car, maybe going to take it to a chop shop. The thief stole the car, so the person who owned the car used it for transportation.
But a liability rule doesn't require him just to give back what he got for it. It requires him to compensate the owner for his loss.
But the owner isn't the best person to know what the best value is.
Ah, so the critical point is in those cases where it is difficult or costly for the court system to evaluate the loss, but where it's easily evaluated by the market transaction, so that we say, look, when I claim that I loved this car dearly, and furthermore, it was a terrible inconvenience because as a result of the car being stolen, I wasn't able to make the date with the woman who would have become my future wife, and she got mad at me, so therefore you owe me $600,000 for stealing my car, the court can't easily tell. But it's very easy to tell whether or not I turned down a $600,000 offer for my car. So in that sense, in those cases where transaction costs are low, and therefore transactions provide an easy way of measuring costs, and especially if litigation costs are high or accuracy of litigation is low, those are the cases where you want the property right. I think maybe that's the simplest way of putting it, that in one of them you are determining values via the court measuring damages. In one of them, you are determining values via transactions on the market. If the court measuring values works badly, that's an argument against one of them. If determining values on a market works badly, that's an argument against the other. And as in your case, if we imagine that we have a property right not to have carbon dioxide spilled into our air, therefore, before the next time I exhale, I need permission from everybody in the world, the market is not a good way of determining that value. Because of the enormous transaction costs of getting unanimous assent from the world's population, whereas if it were a significant problem, liability would be at least a better solution. All right, I think we're out now. Note that there is now a link to the COSA article on the syllabus on the webpage, and you should all have read it by Thursday, and as well as the chapter, of course, which I already read, and we will forget it Thursday. I will photograph this whiteboard for the benefit, just in case anybody is watching this course from a distance, which I admit is unlikely but not impossible.